there are very, very few things that, that Iraqis point to indicate that their lives have improved since the fall of Saddam Hussein. This is now more than 2 months ago.
Bremer has gone far beyond purging powerful Ba'ath Party loyalists and moved into a full-scale assault on the state itself.
Are the Iraqi people truly going to have a chance to build that infrastructure and run it themselves, or is it going to be sold off to United States corporations?
It's our society's intolerance for ideas that differ from their own. That's very dangerous.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, June 20th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Colin Powell said today the Palestinian Authority must strip the group of its terror network, and negotiating a truce, as the Palestinian prime minister has been doing, is not sufficient. As Powell addressed a news conference with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, an Israeli motorist was killed and three people were wounded in a Palestinian shooting attack in the West Bank. Since a Mideast peace summit 2 weeks ago, 27 Israelis and 40 Palestinians have been killed. Four of the Palestinians were killed carrying out attacks on Israelis. Powell said the violence was all the more reason to implement the U.S.-backed peace plan launched at the summit. The peace and urgency of our work needs to be maintained in order to capitalize quickly and decisively on this moment that history has given us, he said. Powell spoke after discussions with Sharon and Israeli Foreign Minister Silvan Shalom. He then began meeting with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, who has been trying to negotiate a ceasefire with Hamas. Powell said he was anxious to speak with Prime Minister Abbas about efforts they are making to end violence, not just through the means of having a ceasefire, but going beyond that to end violence and the capacity for violence. The Pentagon's intelligence branch has issued a terrorism alert to all U.S. interests in Kenya and raised the threat level to high. That's according to a defense official. The warning issued yesterday by the Defense Intelligence Agency is based on specific information about a threat against a specific target, the official said, speaking only on condition of anonymity. Details of the warning, including the target and the nature of the threat, are classified secret. The official would not say whether the target was the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi. There are four terrorism warning levels. High is the highest of the four. A rocket-propelled grenade slammed into an electrical transformer near U.S. troops in Fallujah, injuring two soldiers and sending a tower of flames into the night sky, witnesses and the U.S. military said today. It was the latest in an escalating series of attacks on U.S. soldiers and sabotage against the infrastructure needed for Iraq's reconstruction. U.S. soldiers admitted it is a common practice to kill men, women, and children, even killing the wounded who are unable to fight. An article in the London Evening Standard today also said that morale among the troops is at an all-time low, that many soldiers have seen a psychiatrist because they are not prepared to deal with peacekeeping duties for people they feel are trying to kill them. One soldier was quoted in the story as saying, "One day you're shooting at them, then the next day you're trying to help them." Since Bush declared the end of major hostilities on May 1st, over 50 U.S. troops have been killed at an average of one a day. At the same time, several Iraqi civilians have also been killed, men, women, and children. Scott Peterson is a staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. We spoke with him today about what the mood is on the streets of Baghdad with this ongoing violence.
I think the Iraqis are surprised that that American forces have permitted the insecurity to continue from their perspective. They've been also surprised at some incidents in which Iraqi civilians have been killed, usually in the course of demonstrations by American troops who were basically felt threatened by the violence or by the anger of the demonstrators. But I think also there's a lot of surprise on the American side, the fact that it seems that there is an increasing degree of systematic resistance to American forces in Iraq, probably Ba'ath Party loyalists, those who remain loyal to Saddam Hussein. And basically they're really conducting classic guerrilla operations of ambushes, grenade attacks, things that just kill, as you said, one or two Americans a day, and it really does add up and begin to take a toll. But one that is extremely difficult, a problem that is extremely difficult to solve.
Well, in fact, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz admitted earlier this week that there is, in fact, a guerrilla war
taking place in Iraq, where members of the former regime inflict casualties almost daily. We've heard varying reports of just how much opposition there is among average Iraqis to the ongoing U.S. presence in the region. Would you say there's a clear split between those still thankful to the U.S. for their liberation and those angry at what they perceive as a colonial occupation, or are most people ambivalent? What's your assessment?
I think that people are shifting toward the latter, more cynical view. And this is what I've been finding in the last few days, especially. I mean, people, there just seem to be a growing number of incidents, a growing number of reasons that Iraqis say for them point to reasons why this liberation, which they initially welcomed, of Saddam Hussein being toppled, you know, their views now toward Americans are much more turning toward this as being an occupation force. There are very, very few things that Iraqis point to indicate that their lives have improved since the fall of Saddam Hussein. This is now more than 2 months ago. They, of course, had very high expectations of what American forces would be able to achieve in Iraq. They were expecting a new government within a week. They were expecting all kinds of things. Nobody expected that there would be the kind of insecurity that we've seen for the last 2 months and the kind of insecurity that certainly American troops are trying to deal with it. But as they've conducted their swoops and various military means of trying to solve this problem, it has likewise antagonized many Iraqis even further, because there have been some heavy-handed tactics, other things. And, of course, the Pentagon has for years been the first to admit that it is not set up for police operations. But, of course, that's precisely the kind of thing that they're being asked to do here in many respects.
Police are peacekeeping.
Police and peacekeeping, mm-hmm. because of course a lot of peacekeeping work is similar to police work. When you have, you know, when you have demonstrations, when you have things like that, I mean, as soldiers, American troops will tell you, as they have since from the first Gulf War to Somalia to Bosnia to Kosovo to Afghanistan, they say we're trained to kill. That's what armies do, and police work is really not our bag. But often, as you say, even more and more instances, they are required to play that peacekeeping role.
What do you think, Scott, has happened to all the former military soldiers, Iraqi soldiers, and those that were police officers prior to the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. and Britain?
Well, a lot of those people are still around, certainly, and many of them were demonstrating on Wednesday, where there were two of them at least who were killed by American troops, and there was one soldier that opened fire on the crowd. People in the crowd had begun to throw stones at the American soldiers. They definitely felt threatened, and so then we have this extraordinary scene. Now, of course, one of the things that is quite remarkable is that there seems to be at the moment no indication that American forces are trying to bring in non-lethal riot control gear. I remember, for example, in 1995 when American forces moved back into Somalia very briefly to help remove and evacuate UN forces and UN staffers there. They went in highly publicized with all kinds of the latest riot control gear. And even though they have these things at their disposal, or should, they apparently are not deploying with them here. And you know, that really is the difference when there's tension, a lethal outcome, and one that is where Iraqis don't die.
Mm. In fact, 17 Iraqi civilians were killed while demonstrating in the town of Fallujah at the end of April. The Bush administration reported that the troops were returning fire, but Human Rights Watch reported this week that ballistics evidence shows that there were no bullets fired at the soldiers, that the soldiers opened fire indiscriminately, probably in response to rocks being thrown, as you said. Every day, more and more reports of this type are coming out of Iraq. What is your opinion as to what's going on?
Well, I saw the Human Rights Watch report, and certainly it didn't look particularly good for U.S. forces. As you say, the ballistic evidence seemed to indicate that there had been indiscriminate fire that had hit buildings behind where there were, you know, where demonstrators had been. You know, that this wasn't the kind of pinpoint accuracy that the Pentagon had been saying troops had been using when they fired on the crowd there. In terms of whether or not someone fired from the crowd, there were journalists in those places and also other witnesses. They said that there'd been no shooting. I know that the U.S. soldiers, one of them said that they'd seen a muzzle flash, but certainly unless American troops begin to use non-lethal means of restraining people, and they've got goop guns, which provide a kind, which blast a kind of immobilizing glue. They've got, they've got percussion grenades. They've got other kind of little bee sting grenades and things like that that can immobilize people without actually killing them. And unless they begin to deploy those kind of devices, they are probably going to continue having these kind of incidents.
Mm. In the town of Najaf, over 250,000 residents had actually registered to vote. Flyers and leaflets had been circulated for different candidates a few weeks ago. Then Paul Bremer, the U.S.-appointed administrator, announced that there would be no elections and that he would appoint representatives of the interim government. Do you have any insights as to why this decision was made, and have you spoken with anyone regarding their reaction to that?
Well, I have spoken to officials from Paul Bremer's office, and their view is simply that there was not, that though the process appeared like it was ready to take place in Najaf, what they are hoping to do is bring about a kind of a democratic system in many cities simultaneously. They said that Najaf, that there were some very significant remaining questions that had not been answered, for example, about how you would be able to prevent people from buying off votes and other things. They had a list of criterion that they said that weren't met in Najaf, and therefore they decided not to let that election go ahead. And what they say in a more broad sense is that their ultimate aim is to ensure that there's a democratic system in Iraq, but that the means toward that end are not likely to be democratic. Hence, we have Paul Bremer making an appointment in many cities of people who will be on various councils and who will be running the show at this very moment. They are meeting. He's meeting people all across the country of various stripes, and they are getting to know them, as his staff says, and they are going to be appointing them. And that is certainly not democratic in terms of putting things together, but they say that their aim is to bring about a democratic process that is also not distorted. They were concerned, and they used the word distorted. They were concerned that a vote in Najaf, if it was premature, might yield a distorted result, which was probably worse than having than basically going the other way, an undemocratic way. And they say they're trying to just keep their eye on the real end game.
Mm. And did you get reaction from any of the Iraqis themselves as to them canceling the elections?
Well, I think that the Iraqis at the moment are really focusing on many, many other subjects, and they're looking more at a national government, which of course has been delayed. And I just spoke to a woman this morning, very articulate, speaking English, who said, who warned basically that if the United States did not put together an Iraqi government by August, that Iraqis were going to be so fed up that they were going to attack Americans everywhere. She spoke about American bodies being in the streets, that basically people, even though they appeared to be relatively quiet, were deeply agitated inside.
Finally, Paul Bremer recently signed a proclamation making it illegal to demonstrate against the occupying forces and placing restrictions on the media. What has been the media's response to these proclamations?
Well, the proclamation on the media was really talking about, in four out of the five instances, is talking about preventing incitement to violence, which is much, which is the kind of thing that incitement to violence is the kind of thing that, for example, in the Balkan Wars was an absolute critical tool in the hands of extremists into fanning violence that led to ethnic cleansing and that kind of thing. And this is the kind of result they're trying to avoid here. Now, no question that is a draconian law. It doesn't appear to measure up to our First Amendment standards of free speech and that sort of thing. They say they can't afford to have those kind of standards here in Iraq simply because it's too early, and what they're trying to do is minimize those kind of extremist elements. But it certainly grates against a lot of people, and we will see how they apply it. I think probably that is likely to be the proof in the pudding.
Scott Peterson with the Christian Science Monitor. Any final thoughts on your part, Scott?
Well, I think there's an awful long way to go, and I think, and I hear this from officials both inside and outside the process, that everybody who's dealing with it feels absolutely overwhelmed by the task. But in other words, it has become far larger and is larger than they ever anticipated. And it's one of the reasons why Iraqis are experiencing delays in progress, because there are just so many things that need to be dealt with, so many complexities that were un, you know, that were not thought through before, and so they're trying to put it together and make it work, but it's taking an awful lot of time.
Scott Peterson, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, reporting from Baghdad, Iraq. Why is Paul Bremer, the U.S.-appointed governor of Iraq, hacking away so viciously at Iraq's public sector? That's the question posed in this next commentary by Globe commentator Naomi Klein. Klein says after only a few weeks on the job, he's already downsizing in disguise.
The streets of Baghdad are a swamp of crime and uncollected garbage. Battered local businesses are going bankrupt, unable to compete with cheap imports. Unemployment is soaring, and thousands of laid-off workers are protesting in the streets. In other words, Iraq looks like every other country that's undergone rapid-fire structural adjustment prescribed by Washington, from Russia's infamous shock therapy in the early 90s to Argentina's disastrous surgery without anesthetic. Except that Iraq's reconstruction makes those wrenching reforms look like spa treatments. Paul Bremer, the U.S.-appointed governor of Iraq, has already proved something of a flop in the Democracy Department in his few weeks there, nixing plans for Iraqis to select their own interim government in favor of his own hand-picked team of advisors, and censoring the critical press. But Bremer has proved to have something of a gift when it comes to rolling out the red carpet for U.S. multinationals. For weeks, Bremer has been hacking away at Iraq's public sector like Chainsaw Al Dunlap in a flak jacket. On May 16th, Bremer banned up to 30,000 senior Ba'ath Party officials from government jobs. A week later, he dissolved the Army and the Information Ministry, putting more than 400,000 Iraqis out of work without pensions or reemployment programs. Now, it goes without saying that if Saddam's henchmen and propagandists held on to power in Iraq, it would be a human rights disaster. De-Ba'athification, as the purging of party officials has come to be called, may be the only way to prevent a comeback by Saddam's crew and the only silver lining of George Bush's illegal war. But Bremer has gone far beyond purging powerful Ba'ath Party loyalists and moved into a full-scale assault on the state itself. Doctors who join the party as children and have no love for Saddam face dismissal, while low-level civil servants with no ties to the party have been fired en masse. Nuha Najib, who ran a Baghdad printing house, told Reuters, "I have nothing to do with Saddam's media, so why am I sacked?" As the Bush administration becomes increasingly open about its plans to privatize Iraq's state industries and parts of its government, Bremer's de-Ba'athification takes on new meaning. Is he working only to get rid of Ba'ath Party members, or is he also trying to shrink the public sector as a whole so that hospitals, schools, and even the army are primed for privatization by U.S. firms? Just as reconstruction has been used as the guise for privatization for Bechtel et al., de-Ba'athification looks a lot like downsizing in disguise. Similar questions arise from Bremer's chainsaw job on Iraqi companies, already pummeled by almost 13 years of sanctions and 2 months of looting. Bremer didn't even wait to get the lights back on in Baghdad before he declared on May 26 that Iraq was, quote, open for business. Duty-free imported TVs and packaged food flooded across the border, pushing many stressed Iraqi businesses unable to compete into bankruptcy. This is how Iraq joined the global free market, in the dark. Paul Bremer is, according to Bush, a can-do type of person. Indeed, he is. In less than a month, he has readied large swaths of state activity for corporate takeover, primed the Iraqi market for foreign importers to make a killing by kindly eliminating the local competition, and made sure that there won't be any unpleasant Iraqi government interference. In fact, he's made sure there won't be any Iraqi government at all, at least while these key economic decisions are being made. Bremer is Iraq's one-man IMF. Like so many Bush foreign policy players, Paul Bremer sees war as a business opportunity. On October 11, 2001, just 1 month after the terror attacks in New York and Washington, Bremer, once Ronald Reagan's ambassador-at-large for counterterrorism, launched a company designed to capitalize on the new atmosphere of fear in U.S. corporate boardrooms. Crisis Consulting Practice, a division of insurance giant Marsh & McLennan, specializes in helping multinationals come up with integrated and comprehensive crisis solutions for everything from terror attacks to accounting fraud. Thanks to a strategic alliance with Verser, which specializes in biological and chemical threats, clients of the two companies are treated to, quote, total counterterrorism services. On May 15th, 3 days before he arrived in Iraq, His former boss, MMC Chairman Jeffrey Goldberg, announced that 2002 was, quote, a great year for Marsh. Operating income went up 31%. Marsh's expertise in analyzing risk and helping clients develop risk management programs has been in great demand. Our prospects have never been better. Many have pointed out that Bremer is no expert on Iraqi politics, but that was never the point. He's an expert on profiting from the war on terror and at helping U.S. multinationals make money in far-off places where they are both unpopular and unwelcome. In other words, he's the perfect man for the job.
Naomi Klein is a commentator for The Globe and the author of several books, namely No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies and Fences and Windows, and An Activist Journal from Seattle to September 11th. As Iraq's public sector is phased out under the leadership of Paul Bremer in favor of a free market society, some activists and watchdog groups are raising questions about the backgrounds of those corporations being granted lucrative contracts. U.S. Labor Against the War, a network of labor organizations formed in opposition to the war on Iraq, recently released a report profiling the labor, human rights, environmental, business, and social records of some 18 U.S. corporations granted contracts to participate in Iraq's reconstruction. Peace Watch spoke earlier this week with Bob Mullenkamp, one of the group's spokesperson.
One of the stated goals of the Bush invasion of Iraq was to promote democracy. From a union point of view, you can't have real democracy unless you have democracy for workers. So the question arises, will workers in Iraq under U.S. occupation have the right to form, organize unions, bargain collectively, have democracy in that sense?
And the answer is?
Well, so we looked at the corporations who are getting these no-bid contracts, and some of them have some of the most notorious anti-labor records that you can find. WorldCom is being given a contract to build a wireless network. WorldCom has a notorious anti-labor record with the communication workers, or SSA. The stevedoring contractor was the leader of the employer lockout of the longshoremen on the West Coast a year ago. And you go on down the list.
You're concerned that if this is the kind of behavior that they display in terms of worker relations here in the U.S., that it can only, be worse in Iraq? Or
well, I don't know about be worse, but our official policy, the policy of our government, is to foster democracy in Iraq. Well, what are going to be the principles, the laws, the rules for workers to have the ability to have unions? Will the corporations that are employing these Iraqi workers, will they abide by the labor laws of that country? They don't abide by the labor laws in this country. They violate them. They're unfair labor practice convictions against them. So this is a cause of great concern.
Your report also mentions that MCI, WorldCom, has very little experience in setting up networks before here in this country.
Yes.
Are you concerned about that?
Yes. You wonder why they're doing it. And, of course, the Communication Workers Union speculates that the reason that they're getting a contract is that they are being subsidized by the Bush administration in their bankruptcy problem, that they are on the edge of going under. You know, they don't even call themselves WorldCom anymore. They now call themselves MCI, the name of one of their subsidiaries. So to try to get people to forget that they are the largest fraud, bankruptcy, failure in the history of the world. And now they're getting a government contract from taxpayers in this country. By the way, we also document in there a lot of the offshore tax havens that these corporations are engaged in. So they're getting tax money to do this, but they don't feel like they should pay taxes themselves.
Well, now, you said earlier that these corporations are getting these contracts without having to enter the realm of competitive bidding.
Yes.
For the contracts.
Yes.
I've heard them dispute that in certain reports. What can you tell us that your research has borne regarding this situation?
Our research is that they did not have them, and we are joining with others to ask the Congress to investigate the process by which they got these contracts. And then we're going to add to that from a labor point of view and what is going to be their record with regard to democracy in Iraq.
But who will actually have oversight?
Well, the way it is now, of course, the the only oversight is under the occupation force.
Paul Bremer?
Yeah, under Paul Bremer right now. Well, they're making it very clear that no one has any say other than him. Now, we delivered this report to a meeting of labor representatives from all over the world in Geneva earlier this week. One of the things we're working with other trade union organizations around the world with, including Iraqis, is setting up a group inside Iraq to monitor labor conditions there. So hopefully the United States Congress will have some oversight. We are, in the ensuing months, going to be on the ground with others to get firsthand information about what is happening with how these corporations are treating people they employ in Iraq and what else they're doing over there.
What can you tell us about the history of other U.S. corporations that have set up shop around the world and other nations where the laws are less stringent than here in the U.S., the labor laws are less stringent than here in the U.S.?
Well, I'll give you an example that I know firsthand, which is the most famous, largest, wealthiest corporation in the world, which is General Electric, because I coordinated the contract campaign with GE 3 years ago. And we took a quote from then CEO of GE, Jack Welch, who basically said that he can put a factory on a barge and move it anywhere. And he was referring to GE moving a factory in a short time from Mexico to Thailand. Why? Because the costs of labor and taxes and environmental regulations were too high in Mexico, and he could do better in Thailand. He didn't mean take it off the barge. He meant tie it up in case the cost got too high in Thailand relative to some other place where they could go. So child labor, low wages are just part of it, the cost of doing business. It depends a lot of things. Taxation, what's the cost of abiding by and environmental regulations, all of it. And they keep shopping around for the lowest common denominator, the bottom. And these are some of the most famous so-called reputable corporations in America and the world.
What can people do, corporations do, anybody do that wants to try and have an impact on this situation?
Well, I think there are going to be growing demands in the Congress for hearings on all of these things. We certainly are going to join in building that chorus of demand by citizens of this country to take Bush at his word. We went in there, we sacrificed blood and money. Now, not for weapons of mass destruction, but for democracy. Well, okay, let's have democracy then. You can't rule out all kinds of human and civil rights for 23 million people indefinitely. These corporations are going to be employing hundreds of thousands, who knows, millions of Iraqi workers. What are they going to get paid? What are their conditions going to be like? What are the profits going to be from these companies? But the point is, are the Iraqi people truly going to have a chance to build that infrastructure and run it themselves, or is it going to be sold off to United States corporations?
Bob Mullenkamp is a co-convener of U.S. Labor Against the War. The group released a report this week entitled The Corporate Invasion of Iraq, Profiles of U.S. Corporations Awarded Contracts in U.S.-British Occupied Iraq. In this next segment, we explore a new form of tourism born of the invasion of Iraq by U.S. and U.K. forces. It's performed by the Christmas Coup Comedy Players. It's called Baghdad Tourism. It's produced by Pacifica Stations WBAI of New York and KPFT of Houston.
I'm a traveler. Gone for good, all the clients I've had. I have this feeling of self-pity. Tourism's dead, the city's in ruins, and I'm so sad. The outlook was decidedly blue, but as I walk through the smoky streets alone, it turned out to be the luckiest day I've known. It's looting tours of Baghdad town.
can steal. The looting goes on both night and day, 'cause the U.S. Marines say it's okay. So pack your bags and wear your best suit. Take a looting tour of Baghdad while we still have stuff to loot. How long for looting? How long do we dare? But the occupying army doesn't seem to care. Reserve your flight and come on down. Take a looting tour of Baghdad while Baghdad's still around.
Looting Tours of Baghdad by the Christmas Coup comedy players of Pacifica Stations KPFT in Houston and WBAI of New York. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.